to Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump to make an announcement Thursday whether the U.S. will pull out from a global Paris climate agreement. Reports suggest he will withdraw from the accord on voluntary carbon emissions reductions. Mr. Trump has questioned the science of man's impact on the climate and insists withdrawal will save U.S. jobs. But Columbia Business School professor Jeffrey Heal said pulling out is not supported by all business.
A lot of U.S. business is quite keen to remain in the Paris Agreement because they want the U.S. to have a seat at that table. These are going to be important negotiations. These are going to be negotiations that will affect every country in the world. And the U.S. really should be present in those negotiations. It's silly to just walk out of them.
The U.S. had pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by up to 28% below 2005 levels by the year 2025. Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute said a withdrawal announcement would not have any immediate impact.
It's a symbolic gesture, a symbolic rejection of the importance of climate change, whether it does very much right away to speed up the trajectory of carbon emissions, to me, is quite doubtful, but it certainly doesn't accelerate the reduction of carbon, on the other hand.
Meanwhile, China and the European Union plan to meet Friday to reaffirm their support of the Paris Agreement. Media reports indicate that an airstrike killed Rayan Meshel, the founder of the Islamic State's media outlet Amag, and his daughter in eastern Syria's province of Deir ez-Zor. There has been no independent confirmation and no official comment from the U.S.-led coalition. The website served as the Sunni militant group's news agency announcing claims of responsibility for attacks. This is VOA News. A powerful truck bomb exploded during morning rush hour Wednesday in Afghanistan's capital Kabul, killing at least 90, wounding hundreds. Most of the victims, civilians walking near the German embassy. Several American contractors were wounded. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility, but Afghan intelligence suspects the blast was carried out by the Taliban-affiliated Haqqani network, which has ties to Pakistan. Afghan analyst Nazif Shahrani of Indiana University said such a link would make sense.
The relations with Pakistan is not very good, and Pakistan's relationship globally, and I think, is becoming more problematic for them. And they are desperate. They probably think they may have a chance to topple the government by doing more of these kinds of bold attacks.
President Trump called his Afghan counterpart, Ashraf Ghani, to offer his condolences and to condemn the attack, which came at the start of the holy month of Ramadan. 13 Turkish soldiers were killed when their helicopter crashed in the country's southeast after hitting a high-voltage power line. It's an area near Iraq where the military is engaged in operations against Kurdish militants. British Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, buoyed by rising opinion polls ahead of next week's national election, has challenged Prime Minister Theresa May to a televised debate. Speaking in Bath Wednesday, Ms. May, who has refused to take part in live television debates, said she'd rather meet the public and answer their questions.
It's about getting out and around the country. It's about meeting voters. It's about hearing questions directly from voters. I think that's important. And it's about being open with voters, which I've been in my manifesto about the challenges that lie ahead for this country, but also about the opportunities that lie ahead for this country and how together we can actually build that better future.
The election is June 8. One poll suggests the ruling Conservatives could lose their majority in Parliament. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta Wednesday presided over the opening of a Chinese-built railway, a passenger train made the maiden journey from the port of Mombasa to the capital, Nairobi.
Today, we celebrate one of the key cornerstones to Kenya's transformation to an industrialized, prosperous, middle-income country.
The $3.2 billion project was funded almost entirely by China, replacing a line built more than a century ago by colonial Britain. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is to meet rival Cypriot leaders in New York Sunday in a bid to save the faltering peace process. The UN chief called for crisis talks following the collapse last week of a UN drive to convene a Cyprus peace conference in Geneva. President Trump met his visiting Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Xuan Phuc and welcomed the signing of billions of dollars in business deals, including a power generation project headed by General Electric. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 1st, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Liberia says it is ready to host the 51st summit of ECOWAS Heads of State this Sunday.
We are excited to be able to host this very important international gathering. We are proud that Liberia, after all of the years in isolation, can once again regain its place as a prominent and strong member of the Committee of Nations.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. Cameroon's main opposition wants an inquiry into alleged murders during recent protests in the country's English-speaking region. South Sudan's elderly and disabled face additional risks, and Angola prepares for election this August without longtime President Eduardo dos Santos for the first time in 38 years.
We will not have troubles like Ivory Coast, but of course we have some tensions which come out of the ground inside the ruling party, because there are different kind of interests inside the party.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai, and could big data help solve hunger in Africa? Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says she is excited to host the 51st Summit of Heads of State of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, which opens this Sunday in Monrovia. This will be the first ECOWAS summit Liberia has hosted in more than two decades. President Sirleaf is the current chair of the regional body. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be attending the summit along with the King of Morocco. Liberia's Information Minister Eugene Nambwe says hosting the ECOWAS summit is one more attestation that Liberia is ready to return to the Committee of Nations after years of conflict. The summit comes at a time that some say the regional body's goals of common economic market and mutual defense are more and more being overshadowed by continuing political unrest in a number of countries. But Nambwe says ECOWAS, under President Sirleaf's leadership, has scored many successes in the area of peace, democracy, and economic integration.
We are excited to be able to host this very important international gathering. We are proud that Liberia, after all of the years in isolation, can once again regain its place as a prominent and strong member of the Committee of Nations.
Your president, President Sirleaf, has said that hosting this is a great victory for Liberia. In what respect does she say that?
Since President Sirleaf became the head of the ECOWAS community about a year ago, she has steadily led the West African body through trials and tribulations. And Liberia has been preparing itself in several ways. All of the deficits that we've had have been breached. So our infrastructure deficits have been breached in a significant way, so much so that we are able now to host such a large international conference. This is why the president is very excited and very proud that Liberia can today host such a big conference.
Mr. Minister, we hear that besides the West African leaders, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is expected to come to Liberia to attend this ECOWAS summit. How true is that?
If you remember, President Sirleaf visited Israel earlier in this year and invited the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, to visit with Liberia. He has agreed and he has used this opportunity of the 51st Summit of ECOWAS Heads of State and Government to visit Liberia. He will be arriving in Liberia on Saturday to participate in the conference on Sunday. The Prime Minister will be allowed and given the courtesy of delivering a speech to the heads of states who will be present. Also, we have other prominent guests, including the King of Morocco, who will also be arriving in Liberia and will be participating in the summit. As you know, Morocco made a pitch to become a member of ECOWAS.
Minister Nambwe, who is going to provide the security? We understand that the Israelis are concerned about security and therefore might be bringing their own security network.
Well, every president, including our own president, when she travels to other countries, has her own security with her. But at this conference, the ultimate custodian of the security affairs will be Liberia's own national security apparatus, working in close concert with the security details of all of these world leaders.
It seems that the very good goals of the Economic Community of West African States, for example, common currency, common economic market, a mutual defense protocol, are more and more being overshadowed by political instability and the issue of good governance. What role under President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf do you think ECOWAS has played? Let's take, for example, the situation that happened recently in Ivory Coast.
Under the leadership of President Sirleaf, ECOWAS has made a lot of intervention and has scored a lot of success in various areas. You remember how the president, through her direct mediation effort, along with some of her colleagues, managed to preserve democracy in the Gambia. The president has also been very engaged with the situation in Guinea-Bissau. Although we don't have a complete resolution of that crisis, we can say that in spite of the stalemate, that stalemate did not degenerate into a full-scale military conflict. So the president, along with her colleagues, have scored a lot of success in the areas of preservation of peace and democracy in West Africa. We have a lot of countries in West Africa now that are democratic countries. So we should look at the positive side of all of these things that have been happening.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Angolan President Eduardo dos Santos returned to the country earlier this week after spending almost a month in Spain for medical checkup. There have been rumors that the 74-year-old leader has been suffering from cancer. For the first time, dos Santos, who has been in power for 38 years and is Africa's second longest-serving leader, will not run for another term in the August 2017 elections. He has handpicked his successor to be Defense Minister João Lourenço. Mario Alpavai is a veteran Angolan freelance journalist. He says while Angola may not experience a succession vacuum, which normally happens after a long-serving leader leaves power, there may be some tension if the ruling Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA party, wins due to competing interests inside the party, which have been suppressed for years.
We will not have troubles like Ivory Coast, but of course we have some tensions which come out of the ground inside the ruling party, because there are different kind of interests inside the party, which after dos Santos goes out, they will start to speak out. So that's the kind of situation that we have. And the next president, if the Mr. João Lourenço wins, will need also in the beginning to establish himself. And to do that, he must put aside some people which has been working with President dos Santos. Of course, this change of guard, including in the staff closing to the president, are supposed to raise some kind of tensions.
So, Mario, about the election, which is supposed to take place in August, what do you think are the chances for the opposition UNITA?
I don't think that UNITA and the other opposition parties have big chances to win the elections. We must be aware that in Angola we have still a situation of some kind of party state in the country. In reality, the ruling party, which runs the country, dominates the economy, dominates the public space. The opposition party doesn't have a fair access to, for instance, the public televisions. We have been Mr. João Lourenço, the official candidates, going across almost all the provinces of the country with the public TV, giving in a lot of space, which has been criticized not only by opposition parties, but also by independent analysts and civil society. Apart from that, there are a lot of criticism from opposition parties, especially from UNITA, on the lack of transparency on the electoral process.
I hear that in our earlier discussion that the UNITA is planning some rally or demonstration sometime when?
Yes, it's supposed to happen next Saturday. These demonstrations, you need to call these national demonstrations, at least in the capitals of the main provinces, are supposed to be against the lack of transparency of the national electoral commissions, because UNITA alleged said that the national electoral commissions appoint again two foreign IT enterprises which have a lot of suspicions which coming from the last elections, and according to UNITA, they are involved in suspicion business even out of Angola. Apart from that, there are some details of the process that has been criticized for UNITA. We don't know what really will happen on Saturday. We know that, for instance, last 27 of May, which happens the infamous 40th anniversary of the so-called 27 May 1977 putsch attempt, which have been big repressed by the government of MPLA at that time. Some young people have been attempted to make the demonstrations, but they were not allowed and were repressed by the police. So we don't know at this stage if the government will allow the demonstration that UNITA want to do next Saturday. And we are not also sure that other opposition parties will participate. But what you are seeing is an increase of tensions on the election process.
Mario Alpaiva is a veteran Angolan freelance journalist. He was speaking with me from Tanzania's capital, Dar es Salaam. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 1st. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party has established a committee to investigate murders and destruction of property allegedly committed by the state security during the recent political crisis in the country's English-speaking region. SDF parliamentarian Joseph Banazem says the opposition party will use the outcome of the inquiry to determine its next steps forward. He says the government has failed to compile human rights violations allegedly committed by the state security. But supporters of the government say the criticism is yet another attempt by the SDF to undermine President Paul Biya's government. Parliamentarian Banazem tells viewers Peter Clotty that the SDF wants to know the facts of the alleged atrocities.
We realized that there was a lot of incorrect information from both ends. Either we got information like rumors from the streets, and we cannot rely on that or else we look ridiculous, or we got information from government and we know that the government is not credible. So the SDF decided in the last National Executive Committee meeting to establish a committee which is going to get information internally for the SDF so that we can use and we are credible. We realized that there are divergent views about the number of people who died, number of people who are missing, whom we don't know what is happening, those in detention and where. So there is a lot of information which we need to know and the population needs to know.
Supporters of President Paul Biya, and for that matter the ruling party, are saying that the move by SDF is usurping the powers of the state, since state security agencies are mandated to investigate such circumstances, and that SDF taking such initiative is an affront not only to the constitution but to the state institutions. What do you say to that?
We want, as a serious political party, to establish facts that we can use to demonstrate few things, and also to let the international, those with whom we interact, know exactly what is happening in Cameroon and what we believe is happening in Cameroon that is correct.
How do you react to some of these supporters who are saying that the move will not only create instability and disaffection, but will also create disunity among Cameroonians in such a time that calls for unity of purpose irrespective of political affiliations?
We have not stopped government from doing its work. A government cannot say we are usurping their power. They have all the means to do the work they are supposed to do. If their work is credible, everybody is going to adopt or take the results which they will publish. The issue of instability, I don't know what that means, because we in various aspects take initiatives that belong to the SDF.
How do you react to them who are saying that you should rather petition the government, cooperate with the government to investigate, to ascertain what really happened? How many people were killed? How many people were injured? Instead of taking an initiative on your own, or the SDF taking such an initiative that will derail what the government wants to do in terms of investigating and coming out with the truth?
It's over 6 months since these events took place. And if government were doing its work properly, by now we should have facts about what has happened. Government is just crying over issues which have no meaning. Within the very time, government officials, that is the army, the police, the gendarmerie, committed lots of exactions, destroyed property, and so on. Is government still waiting for us to initiate something in that line before they do their work? Or since 6 months, or even 8 months, or 7 months, they have done any investigation, they should make it public. When they wait indefinitely and the facts disappear or they are distorted, we will never have the truth about what is happening. So that's why the SDF does not want to wait on government. Government has the prerogative, has the responsibility to do its work. Whatever thing we do on our part concerns the SDF. It does not disturb government from doing its own work, which is government regalian responsibilities. If what we want to do is properly done, it will be established that in Bamenda on this day, this person was shot or beaten to death or wounded and so on.
Joseph Banazem is a parliamentarian from Cameroon's main opposition, Social Democratic Front Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Yaoundé. In a country suffering from conflict and food insecurity, conditions are particularly harrowing for South Sudan's disabled and elderly, according to a report released by Human Rights Watch. The group says these populations have been targeted and abused by warring parties, often because of their inability to flee attacks. Jill Craig files this report from Nairobi.
35-year-old Peter Bolwall lost his left leg below the knee during fighting against Sudan in 1994. He now lives in a UN-protected civilian site in Juba, where he says life is not easy.
You know, before when the conflict erupted, it was a bit better because the disabled person is not like able person. Now, when the thing becomes tough, it is difficult for a person with disability to cope up with this situation, and also to survive in the way that other people can struggle for their life because of war.
Human Rights Watch says elderly people and those with disabilities are particularly vulnerable to the effects of conflict that began in December 2013, citing numerous documented instances of people being shot, hacked to death, or burned alive in their houses. Jonathan Pedno is HRW's South Sudan researcher.
Civilians have been and continue to be attacked by the parties. Now, if you're not able to flee ahead of an attack or when the parties come to your house or come to your village, you're automatically more vulnerable to abuses.
Pedno says their caregivers are also more vulnerable.
Now, one also needs to remember that when you're fleeing an attack, when there's bullets flying all around you, it's often very difficult, even for relatives and family members, to carry someone with a disability. It obviously slows you down. So we've had also cases of people with disabilities who have been telling us that they actually asked their relatives to leave them behind because they didn't want to slow them in their flight.
But Pedno notes there is evidence of commanders sparing the elderly and those with disabilities in some situations. He provides an example from February, when Wau Shaluk was taken over by government forces.
One of the commanders who was in charge of the SPLA soldiers there ordered his forces to take care of the people with disabilities. And they were not only brought in one specific place, but then provided also with food and water by the soldiers. And that is interesting because it also contradicts heavily, claims by the parties that often the crimes that we are witnessing are the result of bad apples, that they are the result of indisciplined soldiers, and that it's the chain of command inside the SPLA is so broken down that we can't possibly control the soldiers. And I think those examples show exactly the contrary. It shows that when the SPLA wants to act in a manner that is respectful of international norms and international law, it can.
Human Rights Watch says it interviewed more than 45 elderly people and those with disabilities in displacement sites in Juba and Malakal, as well as in parts of Unity State, where the UN declared famine in February. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Computer algorithms power much of modern life, from our Facebook feeds to international stock exchanges. But could they help end malnutrition and hunger in Africa? The International Center for Tropical Agriculture thinks so. Lenny Ruvaga has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
The International Center for Tropical Agriculture has spent the past 4 years developing the Nutrition Early Warning System, or NEWS. The goal is to catch the subtle signs of a hunger crisis brewing in Africa as much as a year in advance. SIAT says the system uses machine learning. As more information is fed into the system, the algorithms will get better at identifying patterns and trends. The system will get smarter. Information technology expert Andy Jarvis leads the project.
The cutting edge side of this is really about bringing in streams of information from multiple sources and making sense of it. But it's a huge volume of information. The novelty is then you making sense of that using things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, and condensing it into simple messages.
Other nutrition surveillance systems exist, like FuseNet, the Famine Early Warning System Network, which was created in the mid-1980s. But SIAT says NEWS will be able to draw insight from a massive amount of diverse data, enabling it to identify hunger risks faster than traditional methods. Dr. Marcy Lungaho is a SIAT nutrition expert.
What is different about NEWS is that it pays attention to malnutrition, not just drought or famine, but the nutrition outcome that really matters, malnutrition, especially in women and children. For the first time, we're saying these are the options, way ahead of time. That gives policymakers an opportunity to really do what they intend to do, which is make the lives of women and children better in Africa.
While food emergencies like famine and drought grab headlines, the International Center for Tropical Agriculture says chronic malnutrition affects 1 in 4 people in Africa, taking a serious toll on economic growth and leaving them especially vulnerable in times of crisis. Senior Policy Officer Olufunso Somorin is with the Africa Development Bank.
In 2030, 13 years from now, Africa is going to have 200 million children below the age of 5. Now, once a child is stunted or misses a level of nourishment at that age, it affects that child psychologically, economically, socially. So a stunted child in future is actually a stunted economy. So linking issues of nutrition at individual level to Africa's development and transformation on a broader scale is important.
SIAT says African governments will be able to access NEWS via nutrition dashboards, where they can get risk assessments, alerts, and recommendations. The system is expected to become operational in 4 African countries, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Nigeria, by year's end. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we look at reflections of what most voices on the continent say is the Africa that we need, meaning good governance, rule of law, and social and economic justice for all. That's next week right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa.
Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.